We're beginning with a bit of fresh air. How far would you have to walk from where you are now to get to the nearest park? And when you got there, what kind of experience would that open public space afford you? People use parks for all sorts of reasons. For many people, they're a place for physical activity, whether it's a gentle stroll or a competitive game of touch football. For children, they're a place to play or explore the natural world. And for city dwellers, they're a place of sanctuary from urban stress. As Dickens memorably said, parks are the lungs of London, and they're the lungs of many Australian cities and towns. This week in Melbourne, about 1,000 people from all over the world came together to explore how parks contribute to our well-being as individuals and as a society. Which is just what we're going to do now with two of the keynote speakers from the Healthy Parks, Healthy People Congress. Steve Coleman is Executive Director of Washington Parks and People, and Gil Peñalosa is Head of Canada's Walk and Bike for Life, and he also works for New York City's Project for Public Spaces. So what can we learn from their experience? Let's find out. Gentlemen, welcome to By Design.
Thank you, Alan.
Steve, the very word park conjures up images of a place of natural beauty and serenity, but the reality can often be very different. They can actually be frightening places. Tell me the story of Meridian Hill Park in Washington, D.C., better known as Malcolm X Park.
Well, Alan, 20 years ago, Meridian Hill Malcolm X Park was the single most violent national park in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people, including many in the government, had given up on the park as just hopeless. It was the center of the most murderous part of the Capitol at the time when we were the murder capital of the U.S., if you can imagine. And after a boy was killed on Martin Luther King's birthday, just outside the park next to my home, we launched a voluntary crime patrol. No violence, no weapons, just a rule that we had to say hello to everyone in the park and to be multiracial. And out of that effort, we got to know a lot of the folks in the park who had memories of when it had been great, had dreams of what it could be. And we started bringing the music and kids and classes and plantings back into the park. And in 4 years' time, we were able to reduce the crime in the park by over 99%. It became one of the single safest parks in the city, thanks to people coming back.
That's quite amazing, and partly what is amazing about the story is that what you did, with all due respect to your ingenuity, but what you actually did seems quite simple.
It is simple. It's not necessarily easy. It can be tough, but what we're missing in our communities is really quite basic. We need to reconnect with public land and with each other. We can't just hypothesize about community and making our cities work. We've got to get out and walk and play and enjoy these places. And in so doing, we're standing up for a different approach to public life that isn't about virtual community. It's really about these forgotten green places that can be the glue that binds us together, not just the lungs, but really the heart of our cities.
Gil, walking and bicycling are two activities that we associate with parks. But outside parks, many cities are hostile environments for cyclists and pedestrians. And I think you've suggested that planners could imagine parks in a different way, as interconnecting green strips rather than contained spaces.
Yes, actually, there was a wonderful speaker at the Congress that said that if the cities were built properly, you would not actually need parks. The whole city would be a wonderful park. And I think that metaphor, I don't know if it was Richard Love, maybe, that I think that that's a really nice example, that we should be able to get from anywhere to anywhere. And actually, we used to be called Walk and Bike for Life. Now we are called 880 Cities, basically because people thought we were just about doing master plans of walking and cycling. But no, we see walking and cycling as a means, not as an end. It's a means of how to create vibrant cities with healthy communities where people are going to be happier enjoying their public places.
If we didn't have cars, our roads could be turned over to park-like activities such as walking and biking, and there could be play areas for children. Now, in the city of Bogota, Gil, you've been instrumental in achieving this, at least on some Sundays, haven't you?
Yes, well, actually, every Sunday of the year, it's very, very interesting because especially now in a period of economic crisis, when people say they don't have monies to build gymnasiums or arenas or coliseums, here you got the streets. You mentioned the streets as public place. Like the reality is that if you were like a bird and we're looking at a city from the air, most of the biggest public place usually are the streets, and it's not just about moving cars. So what we do on Sundays in Bogota, we close 121 kilometers of roads to cars, and we open them to people. And actually, in the last 2 years, cities like San Francisco, New York, Portland have done similar programs and very, very successful. And this now is being done in big cities, in small ones, in rich ones, in poor ones. And it's really, really fantastic.
Well, moving from Colombia to the United States, from Bogota to New York, Central Park is one of the greatest parks in the world. It was planned from scratch as an urban escape for the residents of Manhattan. In general, though, and this is a question to either of you, depending who wants to take it, but in general, though, it's very difficult to reclaim land that has been built on in existing cities and turn it over to parkland, isn't it?
It is, but there's some interesting models in challenging that. There's a whole initiative in the States called Red Fields to Green Fields that's looking at buying up troubled, closed-down commercial shopping malls and converting part of that land into parkland and then using the increased value to then generate interest in developing the surrounding area for residents. Very much analogous to what was done in Central Park back in the mid-1800s.
Yeah.
No, you're totally right. It's very, very difficult. That's why it's very important that when you have cities like Sydney or Melbourne that are going to be growing by 30 or 40% in the next 25 years, to make sure that the proper green spaces are safe for hundreds of years, because otherwise you have to come either through an economic crisis to have the opportunity to actually tear down buildings and make them into parks. So it is very, very important that when cities are growing to keep that in mind, that we are building space is not just for one generation, but for many, many generations.
Steve, you've talked about encouraging people into Meridian Hill Park and encouraging them to say hello to each other. In Victorian England, parks were places to promenade and to socialise. Aside from changing people's behaviour, are there actually design features that can be built into a park to encourage that sort of behaviour, to encourage social interaction?
Absolutely. And many of those relate to physical health, to mental health, to the economic health of the surrounding community. When we look at design of parks, we're looking not just at the physical elements, we're also looking at the programmatic elements and what I call the invisible park. Are you planning for the feeling of safety, of welcome, of connection to heritage and culture, of invitation to play? We really have to think about how do we give ownership of public land back to the people? How do we really listen, not just to the experts, but to the people who really know what's going on in these places, who are the kids and the families and the older people? Because we have this rule of saying hello, we learn a lot when we go into these once forgotten parks. We learn about the memories of, you know, from people who were baptized in some of these streams in the parks, from kids who have always dreamed of their park coming alive. And we get the best ideas from the people in the communities who truly can own and lead these places.
Well, if our listeners live near a park that has been neglected, which isn't living up to its full potential, what can they do? What would you encourage? Would you encourage them to become sort of guerrilla gardeners and take matters into their own hands?
Absolutely. You know, we can't wait for government. We have to lead the way. And they're wonderful examples. I'm not saying this as a sort of an effort against government. This is an effort to enrich the direct engagement of people in public life. And there've been so many creative things that people have done just by taking the initiative, not waiting for somebody else to do it. You know, when we started that crime patrol, we were told that that belonged to the experts, that we really couldn't do anything to stop killings. And yet we did. And we did it because it turned out that the people in the community had far more wisdom about what was needed than the so-called experts. And the simplest things, you know, we went to a hair, and we've worked in parks all over the city now, and we're now part of an international alliance called Parks for Life that's got folks down under and in the UK and so forth. And we've found that there, as simple a thing as bringing music into a place that was a crime area. We went into a heroin market and converted it into a kids' farm market. It's magic what we can do in parks when we put our minds to it.
So, just to close, what are the elements of a great park, and which is the park in the entire world in which these elements are most notably displayed?
I think it starts and ends with people. You can have the most amazing design, and if it fails with the people, it's not a great park. I love Central Park, and I fell in love with it, and it inspired my choice of profession. But there's so many amazing park systems around the world. But really, Alan, it comes down to people. Are the people engaged? Are they given a chance, and do they give themselves a chance to lead and shape their park in a way that's meaningful for them and their children and their grandchildren, and that contributes back to the health and vitality and economics of those cities? You know, we have a chance with our parks really to transform civilization and to save the planet. It's no less grand than that.
Well, we'd love to hear your views on your local park, what you get out of it, and how it could perhaps be a better public space. Write to us at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. I've been talking to Steve Coleman and Gil Peñalosa, keynote speakers at the Healthy Parks, Healthy People Congress, which has been staged this week in Melbourne. Steve and Gil, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you,
Thank
Alan.
You, Alan.
Coming up on By Design, a major design event in Brisbane, the changing interiors of our homes, and shoes for the Moscow Circus.